This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I'm sure you've noticed that banks are changing. Big banks are getting swallowed up by bigger banks. In my neighborhood, the commercial bank and the savings bank that were across the street from each other both got taken over by a third bank. Financial journalist Martin Mayer explains what's going on in the new updated version of his book, The Bankers. He also includes an analysis of money, credit, and banking in an age of ATMs and electronic money. I asked him first to explain the trend of bigger banks swallowing up smaller ones.
There was a time when most lending was done from banks. Today, most lending is done in the market. And the banks kept growing through this period. It was a very dangerous situation, and the banking industry was in terrible trouble in 1990-91. But what's happening in the banking business is that technology is taking over and the business is being redefined. The Federal Reserve System in 1990 and 91 targeted the profitability of the banks as a major policy objective and organized the world of interest rates in such a way that banks could take deposits from customers and put the money in government bonds and in mortgage paper and make out like bandits, which they did. And the industry recovered its health. But it was part of the Faustian bargain here that it would then consolidate and it would stop trying to grow.
I think the question a lot of people want to know about banking doesn't have to do necessarily with the big picture of banking, but the question is, why are we now getting asked to pay a fee to use money machines?
Well, basically because the banks can get away with it. Let me give you an example of how careless people get on a larger scale. Last year, more traveler's checks were sold than in any previous year. And people take traveler's checks to Europe, and they give them to the hotel to cash, or they take them into a money-changing shop to cash, or they take them into a bank over there to cash. And they get a very poor rate, because all of these people give you a very poor exchange rate. And your money is tied up without earning any interest in these traveler's checks until you spend them. And most outrageous of all, most people charge you a fee to sell you the traveler's check. In fact, if you travel now with your ATM card, you can go to an ATM machine in Spain and you will get pesetas, in France and you will get francs, in London and you will get pounds, you will get a little slip which tells you how much in dollars was deducted from your account, and you will get the wholesale rate that the banks charge each other. Nevertheless, people keep buying traveler's checks. People seem not to be conscious of what the cost considerations are associated with banking. Now, similarly, with ATMs, one of the things that was discovered was that people are not sensitive yet to the question of whether they are being charged to use an ATM and where they are being charged to use an ATM. If you are using a machine other than your own bank's machine, your bank is paying an interchange charge, however, to that other bank. How much of that charge they should absorb because it saves them money not to have to provide an office and teller services, that's a question, that's a philosophical question. Their answer is that they can get away with it. And therefore, the banks have decided, why not? Now, they've been boosting these charges, I think, unconscionably, and I think they will lose by it in the long run because I think banks that are smart will make major marketing campaigns around the fact that you don't have to pay to use ATM machines. Even some of them, like Republic Bank here in New York, will say it doesn't matter whose machine you use, we still won't charge you.
Let's look at the big picture. You say that there's a few banks that sum up some of the different directions that banks are heading in now. One of those banks is the Founders Bank in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. And you consider this a really good example of the new approach to niche banking. What does this bank do differently than other banks?
Well, I ran into Mr. Whalen, who owns and operates the Founders Bank, at a conference in Phoenix. And he took me into his hotel room, and he took out his notebook computer. And, you know, he said abracadabra and pushed a few buttons. And suddenly we were plugged into his bank's mainframe computer in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, where he had all of the records that he would have if he were sitting in his office back home, and where he moreover could make contact with all of the customers of the bank who had tried to reach him, his borrowers, A bank is right across the street from a hospital. They got a lot of doctors. They have a certain amount of medical business that they lend into. And he could get all of that information there. So I was fascinated by it. The question came up, where do you get your money? And the answer is that he has very few offices, and they're not like other banking offices. And people put their deposits into ATM machines. So that he is exploiting the electronic resources. Yes.
This bank is a very exclusive bank. You basically have to apply just to open up an account. You have to apply to put your money in this bank. Well, what's the point of that?
Well, because he expects to have relationships with the people who are there. Now, one of the things all the banks want to do now is private banking for the rich. He wants to have the feeling that he's going to have more business from people other than simply their checking account. But he does not go after just anybody. That's right. As a matter of fact, his cat line is that you go through the same process to open an account as you do to borrow money.
So what kind of services does this exclusive bank provide to its customers?
Well, we're dealing here with an eccentric situation, as is used in the book as an example. He feels that he is the center of a community of people who have accounts in his bank. And he knows them and they know him. And his gag line is that if you're a depositor in his bank and you need a gallbladder operation, he can get you a better gallbladder surgeon faster than your general practitioner can. That he can give you advice about which travel agency will do the best job for you. He has travel agencies who are depositors in his bank, and he is a referral service for business as well as being a bank. This is not entirely original. This is a throwback, but it's a throwback to a time before any of us was born and what the banker's function was in American society. And to the extent that you restrict the number of people you're going to try to deal with, you can still do it.
Let's look at the opposite extreme from the boutique-y bank, and that's the huge bank with a lot of branches. You use the example of the Wells Fargo Bank in your book, The Bankers. How many branches does this bank have now?
Well, they've absorbed First Interstate, and last I looked, I think they had about 1,700. But they're going to cut these way down. They're going to cut them down in total, and they're closing down most of the things that are just bank branches, and they're opening up operations in supermarkets where they'll have, you know, a couple of hundred feet of floor space, a couple hundred square feet. They'll have two or three or four people working there. They'll have ATM machines. They'll have something that resembles a teller's operation, but they won't have their own freestanding branch bank. This will happen a lot. Whether it will happen quite so much as some of the propaganda indicated, I think the final decisions aren't in. But this is a perfectly reasonable way to do things. You're going to deliver a minimal service. You're going to make auto loans. You're going to make car loans on a basis of filling out a form, and you check off certain boxes in the form, and the form goes to the computer, and the computer says, yes, we make this loan, or no, we don't. And you're going to make small business loans on the same basis, and the bank is not going to hold these loans. The bank is going to package these loans into securities that will be sold in the market. The bank is not at risk to anything like the same extent, and the bank doesn't need your deposit money, by the way, to fund the loans, because it's going to fund the loans out in the market. This is a business where there are great economies when you do a large volume, and it is probably all the service that most people want. It's easy to get moralistic about some of this. A lot of people don't want personal service in some of these things. They want to get the business done efficiently and cheaply.
Well, now, let me stop you here. What are some of the services that banks have provided in the recent past that they're not going to be providing for much longer?
Well, certainly on small business loans. I mean, your banker was your management consultant if you were a small businessman. And socially, the great function of the banker was that he made the decision as to who was going to prosper and who wasn't. And there were many loans that were made that were never going to be profitable loans in themselves, but you thought this guy was a good business risk. He was going to get to be a bigger business, and then you'd do more business with him, and it would be profitable over time as a relationship. The tying together of your mortgage loan with other aspects of your bank account, the tying together of the personal loans that you could be made, even the credit card situation. All of these things had a certain value. There was somebody who knew who you were. If you got in trouble, there was somebody you could go to talk to and perhaps negotiate some things out. You're dealing with a bank that sets itself up to be a machine. You know, that this starts to some extent with the credit card. Many people, perhaps most people, don't know the bank that issued their credit card. And, of course, many of the credit cards are issued by things that aren't banks. When people began to lose the identification of their bank with their credit card, they began to lose the notion that they have a bank and the bank is a resource for them, which was not an uncommon notion 15, 20 years ago even.
One thing I've noticed, you know, at local banks is that there really aren't a lot of people who seem to know anything about banking or finance.
Well, I'm not sure that's new. The bank teller, Joseph Schumpeter wrote better part of 100 years ago now about the post office clerk mentality, that even if the man who worked in the steel mill made more money, the man who worked in the post office and didn't have to use his muscles had a higher social standing. Bank teller job was one of those. It was a pretty bad job. There were people who enjoyed it. There were people who enjoyed looking across a counter and meeting their customers once a week when they came in to do the payroll. But for many people, it was grunge work, and it paid badly. But it did have a little social standing. You were part of the bank, and indeed banks were the first places in the United States to set up lunch facilities for their employees and such things. It was all part of the family. The number of people in banks who understand a lot about finance has always been small. You did have a large cadre of lending officers, and it was from that cadre that the leadership of the bank came, who knew a lot about business and knew a lot about small businessmen and was shrewd about it. A lot of them got canned in 1990-91 when the banks were in trouble, and I've been waiting to see them get rehired. And as of now, I've been waiting pretty much in vain. But those were the people who really made the community. I said years ago that you could drive into a small town and by just looking at the condition of the stores and the homes, you knew whether there was a good banker in that town or not.
My guest is Martin Mayer, author of the book The Bankers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Martin Mayer, author of The Bankers. What are some of the new services that you see banks offering? Are there any?
One of the most interesting things, and it's amazing to me that there hasn't been any attention paid to it. The Congress ordered the Treasury Department to make all payments electronically starting in January 1, 1999. On July 26th, 1996, the Treasury Department issued a rule that all new contracts that the Treasury was entering into would have to provide for payment by electronics, not by paper check. After January 1, 1999, by law, people who get food stamps, who get welfare checks, who get federal retirement benefits, who get Social Security, are going to have to make arrangements to receive that money by direct deposit. There is a provision that if it is a hardship for you to have an account, then they will send you a check. But you have to qualify for that, and you have to demonstrate that it would be a hardship. Nobody is ready for this, but it's in the law, and it's January 1, 1999. The reason for this is the estimate by the Treasury that it costs 47 cents for them to make a payment by check and only 2 cents to make an electronic payment. Therefore, as part of the budget reconciliation that ended that whole huge flap last year on the budget, the Treasury Department was ordered to save that much money by this means, by shifting over to electronic payments. We've already got some pilot studies going on. Mostly the bidding has been won by Citibank in Texas, in Ohio, in the 4 southern states to deliver federal benefits electronically rather than by paper. And that's going to come. And the question before the banks is, are they going to be people doing it, or are the electronics companies and the software companies going to step in and do it without the intervention of the banks? We don't know that now.
Do these checks include welfare checks and Social Security checks?
Oh, yes.
That's interesting because, you say that one of the largest growing businesses within the financial sector is the storefront check cashing shop.
That's right. And they have already made noises.
Get them out of business, huh?
That's right. I hope so. They've already made noises that they'll be happy to open individual accounts and accept direct deposits if the banks don't do it. That to me is one of the most discouraging things, the growth of the storefront check cashing system. When I was a lad, factory workers mostly got paid in cash. Brinks trucks pulled up to the gates of the factory and all these pay envelopes were disgorged. And then when they began to say, we don't want to have all that cash around, Brinks trucks get held up, we moved to a world in which employers gave their workers checks. But they would then make arrangements with their bank in the community, even with more than one bank, so the workers could take these checks there and cash them for nothing. And then the employers found they could save even more money by giving people a check and saying, okay, good luck, you find a place to cash it. And these check cashing shops grew up within the last 10 or 15 years, and they ripped people off terribly in the slums. Now, you know, you can argue that they, given the risks that they run and the expenses that they have, their charges are not out of line. But that doesn't matter to me much because it's a crazy system when people can have accounts and when banks can be told that they have to set up very inexpensive accounts to arrange for direct deposit. The Social Security Administration has been selling direct deposit now for 20 years, and more than 85% of people who receive Social Security today receive it by direct deposit to an account, and that presumably is the community that is hardest to change.
Let's look ahead a little bit, your vision of banking for the 21st century. What do you think state-of-the-art electronic banking will be?
Well, from the point of view of the greatest single convenience for a lot of people will be that your telephone will have a slot in it, and that slot will have a card reader for a chip card, a so-called smart card. When you get up in the morning, you'll be able to call your bank, put the card in the slot, and take off it however much money you think you're going to want to spend that day. You'll be able to use that electronic chip card in the parking meter. You'll be able to use it in the parking garage. You'll be able to use it to buy things in the stores. If for any reason you want to have cash, you can take it to the ATM machine and take out the cash, or you can recharge it. But every day you'll be able to handle these problems yourself from your home. And that will be a real convenience. And also, you'll be walking around with something which it doesn't do anybody any good to steal. There'll be a safety factor in it, too. In terms of paying bills, you want to look at the social impact of what's going to happen. Somebody should be worrying about the post office department. First-class mail is bill-related. To the extent that people are going to pay their bill over the wire, either from a personal computer or from a telephone or from a box that's on the television set, which is quite possible, a lot of that business is going to go. Those of us who have, in fact, been paying bills through computers know what a blessing it is. It really is so much more convenient than writing all those damn checks and licking all those envelopes and putting all those stamps on them and taking it around. It's much cheaper for everybody. All of that is going to happen. Now, the other side of this is like every aspect of the electronic revolution. It could be highly selective in terms of the income and educational levels of the beneficiaries, and people who do not have those income and educational levels could be losers, and one would hope that the government will pay some attention to this.
When you look ahead to banking in the 21st century, you predict that there will be no more than 20 banks that control all the banks in the country.
Not me. Others are predicting that. The conventional wisdom is that there will be 20 large banks operating all over the country. These guys are going to be providing payment services, and they're going to be providing commodity-like products like mortgages and car loans. I think there will be several thousand banks, some of them like the Founders Bank that we were talking about earlier, some of them like existing country banks, though they will have most of their technical work done by service companies, would concentrate on finding borrowers in their localities. The problem with national banking and big-time banking is that it doesn't cultivate the people out in the countryside and in the small towns and small cities who are building the businesses that are going to be important in the future and important to those towns. I think that there will be enough lenders, most of whom will call themselves banks. Some will be some kind of finance company. Some will be some kind of community development bank that will, in fact, be going out there looking for the people who need the money and who can make a lot of money employing it. I certainly hope so. It would be very bad for the country to have 10 or 20 large financial institutions, all of which want to operate as economically and electronically as possible, making the decisions as to which small businesses can get some more money to expand and which cannot.
Martin Mayer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Martin Mayer is the author of The Bankers, The Next Generation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.